Podcast, episode 128, Bambi, Twitter Painted.
Okay, we're live now. All right. Welcome everyone to the Rotoscopers Animation Addicts Podcast. I am Mason Smith, your lovely main host, I guess. And then back by popular demand is Morgan Stradling. She is back from her sabbatical last episode. Of course, we want to thank Rachel Wagner for filling in for her. But welcome back, Morgan. How does it feel?
Feels great. It feels like I have not been on the show in a really long time.
Really?
And because it's basically been a month, right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because so we kind of took a...
I am back.
And then Chelsea, our recurring hostess with the mostest, as always, hanging out with us. Say hello, Chelsea.
Hello, everybody.
So Chelsea, unfortunately, is recording on her phone.
No, I'm not recording on my phone anymore. I'm on my normal computer, but my normal computer has... It's like the internet in my house is just really, really bad. Abysmal, basically. So all you get is my...
Abysmal, folks.
You get my voice, and you get my pretty still picture. So yay!
Well, your still picture is so pretty, so that works out.
It's smiling, and it's happy to see you.
And it's happy to see you. I love it. So we have a little bit of explaining to do for those of y'all who have been eagerly awaiting. Of course, on the website, we said it was going to be 6:30, but we actually started recording at 7. So we got to change that on the website. But for you super loyal Rotoscopers listeners who have been hanging out and mysteriously saw the rotoscopers.com live links all change from Ice Age 5 Collision Course to Bambi. In the middle of the afternoon, we kind of all came together and were like, you know what, we really don't want to do Ice Age 5. So
you couldn't twist our arm enough to get us to do it. And I mentioned this a few weeks ago and was turned down. I said, oh, guys, come on. It's funny. They like when we do the bad movies. And I was like, well, okay, I guess. I just really don't want to go out and see this movie. And Chelsea and I had the opportunity to see the advanced screening for this, and we had other things that came up, and so we just sort of passed on it. And then I was like, oh, now I have to go spend money.
Yeah, I was on my way to the theater after work to go see it, and I was just like begrudging the whole thing.
You
did. I was so like, I looked right at my phone at that moment. I'm like, hallelujah.
Yeah, oh my God. Luckily, he spoke up and finally confirmed what we were all feeling, and we decided to scrap it. And here's the thing, guys. I know we are animation addicts, but I'm addicted to the good stuff. Occasionally,
we're always going on and on about how it's like, guys, we should love all animation, embrace all animation. And we're like, I don't want to watch Ice Age 5. I want to watch a Disney classic.
Well, and one thing that Mason always does say is whenever we see certain things that are announced or whether it's live action or not, you know, Mason does say, you know, if you want them to stop making films like this, stop seeing them. And I really do want them to stop making these films.
Oh,
so
power of the purse,
that's
people.
Why we are not reviewing this.
Yeah, this because... is our protest episode against the Ice Age franchise. We have nothing against Blue Sky, but enough is enough. To quote Jiminy Cricket. So we got Melissa Long, who said, I actually was glad that my ticket ended up being for free, .. You didn't miss much. And so we've actually got a couple of voicemails that will play at the end that will kind of be our episode for Ice Age 5. We had two people call about Ice Age 5, and so you'll get to listen to those. But yeah, other than that, like... we changed our minds. The lucky Greg Wilde, who is our patron, who selected Bambi for this episode, this could be either really good or really bad for them, because maybe they're expecting the Bambi episode to come out in 2 weeks, but it's coming out now. And so they'll still get to listen to it, just maybe not live. I don't know. I never see Greg on the chat. This is the first I've heard of Greg, this supposed Greg Wilde. So.
Well... we are doing Bambi. It is quite a shift in tone from what we were going to do, which is a fifth quill, or don't even know what to call it, to this. Yes. And Mason, as usual, has brought sound effects that are appropriate for the movie, which we are going to be reviewing.
I was watching the meter and it was really high, so let's try that again.
That was really, really a lot.
Okay, that's a little better. Jump scare, everyone.
Okay, so just real quick recap. For those of you who are new to our show, The Animation Addicts is a podcast where we talk about all things animation, or almost all things animation. It turns out there are even some things that we will not touch unless
we'll do
truly
a review
desperate.
On the site. We'll do a review on the site.
Well, yes, yes. We'll do a little.
There was already a review on the site.
Well, then we're good. We're gold.
I think we're good.
Then we're set. Okay. But what we do is we talk about an animated film, past or present. This episode, we are going into the past. We do have some patrons via Patreon. And so whenever we are reviewing an older film, we allow the patrons, one of the perks is that they get to help pick the films. So this is one of the patron picks, and it's going to be Bambi. And I'm really excited to talk about this. I have much more positive feelings and emotions towards this film. So that's great. That leads to a better discussion, but it seems also in the chat that a lot of people are okay with our decisions. So, but typically we do try to review most of the newly released animated films. Not all of them, but however, we do quite a few more than we used to. So stay tuned. I think the next one that we will be doing is Kubo.
Oh, I thought that was Sausage Fest coming up.
Yeah, we won't be doing that one. But the Kubo, I am so excited about.
The Kubo, she
the
called
Kubo.
It.
The Kubo. Legend of the Kubo. Rise of the Strings.
All right. So, shall we jump right into it?
Yep, yep.
Boing.
Yeah, don't start the podcast until you hear the... Yeah, until the bang.
Love is a song that never ends. Life may be swift and fleeting. Hope may die, yet love's beautiful music comes each day like the dawn. Love is a song that never ends. One simple
Disney Animation Studios. So this was released in 1942. And the release date is kind of telling. So released in the beginning of World War II, as y'all probably have guessed, Walt Disney didn't release another full-length animated film in theaters until 1950 because of the war, and there was a shortage of workers and shortage of, I don't know, textiles. There were more important things to focus on, apparently. And can y'all guess which one it was that he didn't release until 1950?
Isn't that Snow White?
It wasn't Snow White. Snow White was the first animated film that Walt Disney released.
Oh, not Snow. I mean Sleeping Beauty.
It was Cinderella.
Cinderella in 1950.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
So,
well, here's the thing. This was actually after a book.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That was weird.
Yeah.
And the book is not like the movie, kids. Don't go reading the book until you're an adult.
Well, when Walt Disney first read Felix Salten's Bambi, A Life in the Woods, and he read it first in 1937, which was the same year that he did Snow White, or that Snow White was released, but he was just like so taken by it that he wanted to do a full feature on it. And it was like from the deer's life from birth to maturity was like, he loved the feeling, he loved the tenderness, and he's like, this has got to be done. And just like the amazing just the backgrounds, everything involved with this movie, I think was for him something that he wanted to move forward. He wanted to do lifelike things, and just really, and all of the artists really wanted to push forward in the realm of realism,
naturalism, you know, having to do with nature. I was surprised this was based on a book. And this was actually in production for a long time, like you said, during Snow White, you know, Snow White's production, and then this went on for a while. And so I don't know, in a perfect world, maybe this was like supposed to be the second Disney animated film or something like that, but ended up being quite a few films after that. But yeah, naturalism, not set in a fantasy world. And that is one of the many, many things that sets this film apart from the other Disney classic canon, basically, in the, you know, the classic golden era. Do we call it the golden age back then, or do we just call it like the proto Disney age?
The golden age. Have you not been following our Disney canon countdown?
Golden age of powerful animation gods and extraordinary animation heroes. So can we name other Disney animated films that don't take place in a made-up fantasy world? So it has to take place in an actual country, like confirmed in an actual country that exists. So Arendelle does not work.
Yeah, I was going to say you could say Lady and the Tramp.
Since we're on the concept of dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, London. All the ones that occur in London and Europe and Paris. So we've got Aristocats, Basil of Baker Street. What's it really called? Great Mouse Detective. Yeah, I was
thinking Great Mouse Detective.
Wait, so what is your definition of non-fantasy world? Because all of these have...
Okay, so it could be like a world of talking animals.
All these have
animals.
Like fantasy elements, like talking dogs.
I guess...
Because the only ones that I really could think of was Lady and the Tramp. That's like... This is happening in their world, but in our world.
Not set in a fantasy world. So maybe we should switch it and just find the ones that are in a fantasy world, because there are quite a few that don't take place in a fantasy world.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level. The who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Or am I just...
No, I'd say it's the other way. Like, as far as, like, this is real, all except for that...
I mean, like, Tarzan is in Africa.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
But it has these fantasy elements, so... I think most Disney films have a fantasy aspect, whether they're set in reality
or
not. Does
The Little Mermaid take place in a real-world setting or a fantasy world? Like the world, like the geographic region.
Fantasy world. I mean, it's supposed to be not Norway area or like Baltic Sea. Anyway.
Oh, Ratatouille's in Paris. Rescuers Down Under is in Australia. Beauty and the Beast is in France. But is it... It's still kind of a fantasy world. I don't know. It could be argued like what the world is. Does the character create the world? Does the setting create the world? But anyway, this is about as natural as you can get. It's basically, the canon is that it's a forest in Austria. Not the United States. It's in Austria. And they had to change them from roe deer to white-tailed deer because Disney said so. Do you need any other reason?
No, it's because the book was Austrian. Everybody who went to do any type of like field trip, you know, to go do research, they all went to places in the U.S. And so like the one of them was in Maine. They went to the forest in Maine, and then some others went to like somewhere in the West area. So you're getting hours as far as pictures and sketches and things they brought in.
Yeah. Oh,
they even brought deer into the studio.
They seriously did. So live action reference. This is a supremely important thing in animation. Can't stress it enough. You need a live action basis to reference your animation performance off of. Of course, you could deviate with any level of abstraction. But if there's no reference point for the audience, they just won't connect. Like even alien designs they have a real world connection. Like, Jar Jar Binks is basically a horse and a slug. I get it. Maybe that was a bad example, but it's basically a Cajun,
Jar Jar Binks?
A Cajun horse alien. Oh, picture that okay. in your head. And that's Jar Jar Binks. Anyway, so yeah, reference. But as we will learn, just reference for reference's sake isn't enough, because they brought in two deer. They were aptly named Bambi and Faline. Yeah. Oh. Faline, is your dough ready? The matchmaker is not the patient deer. Nailed it. I just thought of that right now. So they brought in live animals, but they were domesticated. I don't think so. Y'all got the stench of domestication all over you, pets. And Secret Life of Pets. Gotta love that snowball.
Yeah, there you go.
But they, you know, they didn't act like they do in the wild. So they had to look at live action footage of like documentary style wildlife films. And that is a huge lesson that I've actually learned over the years, is that reference for reference sake, like, sometimes you'll have the opportunity to show your performance to an instructor or someone in the industry. Almost always they will ask, can I see your reference, or show me your reference? And you can't just show them. When that happens and you're looking for reference for your animation, don't just go looking for, don't just Google deer in the woods. Like, you need to Google exactly what you want the deer to do so that you can capture that performance and base it off of that. So
it's all about good acting.
Yeah, it's all about good acting. So you wouldn't say, well, when I did this sword fight, I looked at a footage of Sir Ian McKellen walking in the forest as my inspiration. It's like there's a disconnect there. You got to find actual sword fight reference to base your performance off of. So anyway, kind of an animator's lesson for y'all. But the animation was kind of complex because we're dealing with kind of naturalized characters, but they emote. It was really hard. Some of the stuff they couldn't do. They had to, like, rotoscope the Great Prince's antlers from reference. Can we just appreciate the fact that there is previously unknown and sort of shadowy Disney prince that we don't know about, and that is the Great Prince?
Yes.
What is he the prince of, and what makes him so great? Like, did he beat
prince
all the other...
Forest.
He's the Prince of the Forest, so there's no king. So he has to marry a princess, or he can't become king.
I am king.
Exactly. And he doesn't seem to want to settle down. He has quite a few ladies, so he'll forever be a bachelor prince.
So
I wonder how much alimony he pays.
Yes, it is a shadow prince, young mind of films. And it was Mark Davis who turned to child psychology, and he opened up some books. This is apparently part of their inspiration for Bambi as a child, Bambi's facial expressions and character. Opened a book on child psychology, and they had photos and references of, you know, this expression means this, this expression means this. If your child is making this face, get them out of that dangerous situation. But, yeah, they did that to get the recognizable facial expressions. It's tough. You can't be like a Watership Down. You know, this was a Disney film, so they actually had to you know, have that real world reference for their facial expression.
Mm-hmm. Although it'd be hard to relate to the characters or kind of understand, or just to relate on that extra level. So one thing that stands out to me about this film is the background paintings. While it still is a watercolor-esque, it is very different from the type of, you know, fairy tale watercolor backgrounds that we see in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And the reason it took a different feel was because Tyrus Wong was involved in the pre-production for this and really came up with some initial sketches and paintings for the film that really set the tone of what the design was going to be. And I love his background paintings because I think the paintings of Bambi just feel so different than any other Disney film. They're very airy and soft and, you know, very wispy in a way. And so I actually have seen some of his paintings at the Disney Family History Museum, which is in San Francisco. They have a wonderful exhibit with basically tells the story of Walt's life from the very beginning through all of the productions that he was involved with. And once you start really hitting the studio years, there's lots of pre-production art that is on display. And also a few years ago, there was an exhibit entirely focused on Tyrus Wong. It was called Water to Paper, Paint to Sky, The Art of Tyrus Wong. It also had an accompanying art book, which you can find on Amazon. I'll include a link to that. It is out of print, so it's quite expensive. However, I wish I would have got my hands on one while I was there. But that was from August 2013 to February 2014. And I think I was there in March 2014, so I barely missed this exhibit. And I was kind of bummed because I really do like his artwork. But I'll just give a little history, you know, a little just history about him, because I think he's very, very interesting. So he actually was born in 1910 in China and is still alive today. He's 105 years old.
Whoa.
So, they, which is absolutely incredible. Yes, please tell me your secret.
Long and happy life.
He and his father immigrated from China when he was a young boy, and he left his sister and mother there. And so I'm getting this from the Walt Disney Family History Museum little biography about him. I'll include that in the show notes. But he never saw his mom or sister again, which is really sad. However, he came here. He became very interested in art. And eventually, just to kind of shorten the story, he did start working for Walt Disney. He had a wife and a new child, and so he needed a job. So he started working. He was an in-betweener, and he thought it was completely mind-numbing. And then he heard that they were going to be doing the story of Bambi. So he went and read the book. And, quote, he says, he thought the story was very, very nice. The feeling you could almost smell the pine. And so as a result, he went out and he made sample sketches of different forest settings and very lush mountains. And they were very Chinese-inspired of the Song Dynasty landscape paintings that you would see of that era. And so it has a very Chinese feel to the sketches and the art that he did. And they loved it so much that they ultimately included that and that style as the background style for the film. So
beautiful.
Probably one of the things he's most known for. And I think it's absolutely mind blowing that he is still alive today at a ripe old age of 105 and he's kicking it. So
ripe and old. That's, attaboy.
That's amazing.
We should have him on the show.
Yeah, right?
He lives in China now. He's back home.
We can make it happen.
We'll make it happen.
We can
anyone has contacts,
diplomatic
let us
lines.
Know.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
Keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros. Two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude. Stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
He was actually made a Disney legend. You know,
wow.
So. I would hope so.
Yeah,
the highest honor.
Yes. What we're all striving for in life, no?
Maybe someday we'll be Disney legends, or we'll just be on their blacklist of annoyances forever.
Done and so, done.
Yeah. So beautiful background paintings. And guess what? They're tiny. Like, they're like this big, you know, because they're animation cells. So they got to paint on that. Well, actually,
what? No.
I know that animation cells are bigger than that because the actual animation cells are bigger than that. But I saw a documentary you just Google like making of Bambi. And they showed us one that was, like, tiny. I don't know why they had to be tiny. Maybe because
the ones I saw were quite large.
Maybe because they're doing multiplane, and some of them had to be bigger. I don't know.
Perhaps.
I know I saw it on the YouTube video, the little documentary.
The YouTube is
anyway,
always...
they just had a teeny tiny little painting.
They could have done, like, thumbnail type things
that
for
the
color
cells
keys.
After, like, the final... I don't know.
Maybe that's
microfilm.
We need
to do more research on this.
Speaking of multiplane, this was actually... this was done on 9 separate levels.
Oh, yeah, that's advanced.
Photographed at all at one time. So I was just like, that is pretty awesome.
You don't go to just level 9.
That
and
is
I bet
pretty
that's not
bad.
Even their final form.
Probably not.
Anyway, lots of complex
it was all
animation.
Done in oils. That was I thought that was a cool, interesting thing.
Ooh, oils.
As a poise to tempura, which was normal.
Yeah, yeah.
He was like, give me my oils.
Is it just me, or is April Showers, the sequence, arguably, like, the most complex piece of animation in the film? Like, do y'all realize how hard it is to hand-draw water droplets, like, running off of leaves and splashing into water, and it all has to be in rhythm to an audio track. Like they have they had dope sheets and stuff, which is a technical term for like figuring out your timing back then. And so by that time they kind of had it down, but man, that's so complex. I can't even imagine. Well, first they went with reference. They got the old bowl of milk and the droplet of milk and the whoop, and it makes these crazy splashes in slow motion. And of course, as an animator, you want to exaggerate that or it just won't read. Happens mm-hmm. too fast for our naked eyes to, well, I don't know what you would put on your eyes to be able to see these things. So just your regular eyes. And it happens too fast because, you know, the persistence of vision and stuff like that. And so, and then not only that, but you've got that interacting with the foliage, and then the foliage is interacting with the animals, and it's this huge kind of choreographed sequence. And man, my hat goes off to them for that. You know, not only are they doing these complex animal animations, but just this effect in specific was just mind-boggling.
I would say the music in general tied all together was pretty crazy. Like, it was really good. I loved this song, and I still love this song. I was mentioning earlier before the show started that I was always so mad that our school never, every time we started a new piece ever, I would always be like, hey, we should totally do April Showers. We should totally do April Showers in choir and orchestra, because I was like, that'd be amazing. Get everybody together, do that. Jip, 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 little April Showers. So I was like, oh, let's do it. And they never took me seriously, which made me really sad.
Because it's so obscure. That's the thing. Like, these songs are great.
That is not obscure.
But yes, yes, that is. Compared to some of the Disney great songs out there, A Whole New World, Beauty and the Beast, April Showers. I mean, these songs are not necessarily on people's, like, top playlists. Like, when I have my Disney playlist on, these are ones that are not my favorite compared to some of the more Broadway-esque ones. In the context of the film, they work great, and I think they're perfect, but they're very specific to this movie. April Showers is a good one that maybe out of probably, well, it's a little more universal, but it's yeah, I think it's more of an obscure one than,
well, I think
Chelsea would like.
Yes, I know. But I mean, honestly, I think that the Sherman brothers were really what changed Disney. Like, this is an interesting thought. Like, you look at all the songs prior to when the Sherman brothers came in, and it was like, they're just not as catchy. They don't have as much of a
what's catchier than April Showers?
And no, it is, but that's what I'm saying. But all the other songs, though, like, I don't know. But it's like, there's a lot of those songs. I think during the Golden Age, it was just a totally different style of music around in general. You know, it was more of a classical time. People really liked
the falsetto.
Yeah, yeah.
With a smile and a song.
Exactly. And so I think that was probably one of the reasons why, maybe. I don't know. It's just, things changed so much in the 50s. You got Bippity Boppity Boo. That's when that one came in, and that was
that was catchy back then.
That's every, yeah. But it was about 1950 when things became, in general, and musically, it just became a lot more accessible to the broad public.
Can you imagine a world and an era and a time when Bippity Boppity Boo was like the hippest song out there?
What a day to be living.
And contrast that to what we deal with now for popular music.
Yeah.
Anyway, so let's talk about the characters. So this basically tells us the story of this young deer's life from basically being born. Although we don't see that part, but very, very, very new to maturity.
Mm-hmm. And surprisingly, only barely over an hour long.
Basically.
So how do you feel about Bambi as our protagonist? Bambi does speak, although I feel when I think about this film, he does speak and does have lines, but there's a lot more, it's less than other films. It's not very dialogue heavy.
Less is more.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it definitely is there.
This could be Wall-E before there were there was Wall-E.
Yeah.
Bambi.
They call me Thumper.
Oh my gosh, you said it. I've been triggered with Thumper. Move over, Bambi. Thumper deserves his own section of the pop. Bambi is great, Morgan. But Thumper, he is amazing. Forget Snowball. In my opinion, forget Bugs Bunny. I don't know. It's close. But Thumper is one of the most hilarious and entertaining animated bunnies out there. I love him. I love Thumper.
Thumper, what did your father tell you?
Oh, yeah. What did your father tell you this morning?
This morning?
If you can't say anything nice...
Don't say anything at all. Which stays with us. My mom always told me that.
Yeah, I didn't learn that one specifically from Thumper, but I identified it from with him, you know, as getting that lesson. But yeah, and then the classic, what did I tell you about what?
about what?
Eating the blossoms and leaving the greens. Oh, that one.
You know what the modern day equivalent of that is? What did I tell you about eating the marshmallows out of your cereal and leaving the crappy chunky part?
And leaving the crappy chunky parts.
It's basically, yeah, you're eating the good stuff and leaving the filler.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I love Thumper because, and I think it was... I always get it mixed up, which is an animation sin, but it was either Frank Thomas or Ollie Johnston. Maybe it was Ollie Johnston who was talking about his treatment of Thumper and how he thought he was very fun because he'll have one sequence and he'll have several emotive beats during the same shot. And so he goes from happy-go-lucky and precocious to Bambi, where he's like, no, not that green stuff. Just eat the blossoms. And then... It's this perfect moment where he's like right there about to eat it, and then Thumper, and then oh crap, and then he's ashamed, and then he's trying to, he's trying to ignore it or like diffuse the situation, and then he has to say it, you know, and then he gets a last laugh because it sure is awful stuff to eat. I made that last part up myself. So he's just really great. And as it usually happens, like, Ocarina of Time and Final Fantasy I, when they grow older towards the end, it's not as fun.
It's not.
There
it
are
really
more important
isn't.
Things to do, like saving the world and finding a mate. Saving the world was Final Fantasy I. I don't really think you find a mate in that one, but there's a transformative thing, And Thumper and the rest of the gang are... Oh, we haven't even talked about Flower. Flower's kind of a dopey dope.
Flower. Oh, poor Flower. He's just kind of... I don't know. That's okay. He can call me Flower if he wants to.
I love it. Oh, I also love how Thumper is the oddball. You know, the classic animation trope where it's like kind of the oddball character. He looks distinctly different from the rest of their group, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But... And Thumper's really fun. But that's kind of not the point of the film, and we need to acknowledge the elephant in the room. We gotta talk about Bambi's mom.
Oh, jeez.
Spoiler alert, she dies. This is why Bambi appeared on Time Magazine's Top 25 Horror Movies of All Time list in 2007. Because we are faced with the real... an irreversible death of the main character's family. Like, normally in a Disney film, the parents are dead in the prologue or way before, hence orphans. It's like the animation trope of the 19th century, of the 20th century.
Right. But
Bambi, it takes it so much further. In the words of Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnston, they said, "We think that Bambi was Walt's favorite picture." That's a high order. He says, they say all our pictures were different, but this one was the most different. The death of the mother is the one picture where somebody is really killed. and there's no fairy dust or lover's kiss to bring her back to life. She's dead, and I think that's the big thing that made this so different. Unquote.
I'll go with that. And do you know what's interesting? I know a lot of people who are, you know, if they saw this movie in theaters, it left them so scarred for so long that it's still something that they bring up. Like, I know of that generation, like, I've talked to a couple of people that are just like, oh my gosh, Bambi, no.
People have mixed feelings about it.
I would not consider this a horror film. It has one scene that is slightly traumatic, but I never necessarily thought this was so traumatized that the mom died.
This has everything to do with kind of this environmentalist message where man is the bad guy.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510, you're declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
You know, it's a man thing. Or Once Upon a Forest, you know, I'm looking at you. And so, no, I don't consider this a horror film. And you know why? Because I grew up in South Texas. We eat deer. And sometimes we kill them for their trophy. And my personal belief on trophy hunting is a little more complex. But I was never really that affected by the mother's death. I mean, it's sad. Like, it's definitely sad. I'm not like this, like, sociopath who can't emote with these characters. Mm-hmm. But I didn't exactly swear off of venison for the rest of my life after it. So what about y'all? How did it affect y'all? And
I don't remember being particularly traumatized by this scene. I always remember watching this from a very small age. I think obviously I was sad and saddened by the loss of the mother. And sometimes, you know, you get a little choked up. Even now, if you haven't watched it for a long time, like, it is a very emotional scene, and it just, I love the way that it's just, the way that it's presented, the way that it's choreographed.
Oh my gosh.
You know, with it, there's just so much setup and build up. There's the quail. Well, first off, you know, they're eating in the meadow, you know, kind of just having a little bit, and then she perks up, and, you know, obviously danger, something's wrong. She says, Bambi, you know, go home. And it's just very, you could just see in her face how serious things suddenly are. And so they start running, and there's even the quail that is that we're like,
the
I
ominous.
Just can't take it anymore. And she flies out and she gets shot, and it adds,
yeah, that one.
You know, seriousness to the situation. And then Bambi basically is told to run and not look back. And he does. And then, you know, he's panting and he's breathing. Mother, mother. And, you know, he walks out into the snow, and she's not coming back, and it's really prolonged. And then finally we see the great prince, and he basically breaks the news to her. And it's quite a very emotional and well done scene. I love everything from how it's set up to executed to the payoff at the end. Brilliantly done.
Brilliantly done. And it's, I mean, that tugs at you. For me, it's hard to tell if the guy was using a rifle or a shotgun. Sorry. That's what I'm thinking throughout this whole thing. I'll match your thunder tube and raise you one.
I was like, can we tell the difference between the gun and the thunder tube?
Yeah.
Chelsea just shot your thunder tube, so...
Yeah.
You're going to have to buy another one on Amazon.
Yeah.
Dang it.
But you know, you got to face it. And this is what makes Bambi such a powerful film, is because we're dealing with this death. And it's like, I feel like in animated films or Disney films, like, man's impact, negative impact on the environment and on animals and stuff is there. And it does happen. But this one is just so direct.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's dead. And
well, man is the enemy in this. You know, man is in the forest. You know,
man
it's
is
very,
in the forest,
and man causes the big fire at the end. And
the
it's,
big fire, yeah, it, never
it's
shown
kind
on
of
screen.
Anti-human in a way, which
well,
as humans,
I have,
is a bit frustrating.
I don't know. I have a different opinion on that, and like I said in the chat, like. We don't want this to kind of devolve into a political discussion, but it's such an interesting part of this film because most of the film's antagonists, with the one exception being Rano, that jerk that Bambi had to fight to get the dough. I mean, that's nature. Animals will do that. Most
and
of,
men.
Yeah, but we don't necessarily have to have fist fights to get the girl we want.
It's true.
But most of the 90% of the film's antagonists are men. And let's not be sexist. There could be women hunters out there. Huntresses, if you will.
Yes.
Never shown on screen, but apparently, according to the making of featurette on the Blu-ray, Walt wanted the hunters to get killed by the fire that they started themselves.
Mm.
As kind of a poetic justice.
And, yeah.
And then there's the sad case of Gobo. Do y'all know who Gobo is?
No.
Gobo was a character in the film. I think he was Fa Lien's brother, so that would make it brother-in-law or a cousin.
Fa Lien.
Yeah. And so Gobo was a discarded character from the original novel. Fa Lien's twin brother. So that would be Bambi's first cousin. Oh, yeah. Spoiler alert, in the book, Bambi and Fa Lien are cousins, but animals do that all the time. It's fine. And Gobo's death is a major part of the novel. So Gobo actually was wounded, and he was found by a man. He was nursed back to health, and the man actually released him into the wild. So I'm reading this, and I'm like, oh, that's cool. Like, a man with a kind of a conservationist mindset took poor Gobo in, nursed him back to health, and released him back. What happens later in the in the novel is that Gobo thinks that men should not be feared because of his experiences, and then later willingly approaches a hunter who shoots him like point blank, basically.
Oh, jeez.
So the book is very dark.
Wow.
So I'm laughing because it's like an awkward, outrageous laugh. Obviously I don't laugh over the death of an animal. I'm actually very harsh on people that are cruel.
Well, just
animals.
The irony of the situation.
Yeah,
where,
no,
you
it's
know,
just the irony of the situation and kind of this mixed message. And so there is, I would say it is a conservationist message in the film and not an environmentalist one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Conservationism is all about respecting nature and what's the other R word? Oh, I wrote it down. I had it all written out. Respect and responsibility.
Yeah, that's the message that I get from this is that, you know, you see the fire that is not tended for, it is just kind of left and the actual destruction and mayhem that it caused. And it really makes you think about, you know, Smokey Bear, and you got to take care of, you know, be conscious of our place and what we are leaving behind and the effects that it causes, because one little fire ended up destroying an ecosystem, right?
And it happens yearly. You know, forest fires are still a huge problem. May not necessarily be because of an arson or because of neglect, but it usually is us that starts them. And it's a reality you have to face. But if I were to try to dissect Walt's vision for the film regarding man, from everything that I've read and everything I've seen, he wanted them to be this, like, antagonist, this, like, force of nature that... the animals have to kind of deal with and live with. And it's like in Princess Mononoke, where it's like, yes, nature and man can live together, but man will usually make a ton of mistakes in the process. So can there be forgiveness, you know, after nature has been so violated, is there redemption and stuff? And so it's this kind of ongoing question, you know. And my problem with what the buzz about this film is that Walt, I don't think Walt never ever meant to portray man as evil or condemn the hunters. Mm-hmm. They sort of just are. But as frequently is the case with entertainment, you know, activism and activists, they adopt the film as their vehicle, as their representative. for their ideology, and the original context gets lost. And so that's why I think it's good to have a level head. Some people say this is an environmentalist film that casts man as the evil villain. I tend to think it's more conservationist, where man is an antagonist because of their carelessness. So I don't know. It's really up to you to decide. But I will tell you that there was backlash when the film was first released.
Tell me more.
Okay. Apparently, in an early case of political correctness, the premiere of the film was scheduled to be in a small town theater in Maine. And that's the hometown of animator Maurice Day, who originally brought the book to Walt's attention in the first place. So they were going to have the premiere in his hometown, small town in Maine. But the premiere was canceled and moved somewhere else because the state of Maryland feared that hunters would be offended by the film. So, and then in 1942, the year that it was released, Raymond Brown, who was editor of Outdoor Life magazine, he called the film, quote unquote, the worst insult ever offered in any form to American sportsmen.
See, that's interesting. I don't really necessarily see, I don't see the hunters being portrayed negatively. I mean, they're just doing what they do as hunters, which are hunting animals. You know, I guess if the hunters are presumed to be the same people who start the fire, that's a little different. But as far as the actual act of hunting, I don't necessarily see any problem with it. I mean, it is presented from the animal's point of view. And it so is. You are more inclined to not like the hunters and to paint them with a negative brush.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's the whole point of storytelling, is just showing from different sides.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
And if I could very briefly, I had this whole thing typed out, but I'm going to condense it. If I could briefly go into the technical aspects of the actual hunting involved, like if I was going to do a shot by shot.
Do it. This
This takes a while to load up, so I can't be very good at timing it. But so one of the questions I am asking myself, I don't know if anyone else cares, but is, were the hunters there illegally? So I looked up in Austria, roe deer hunting season is from the 1st of May to 15th of October, or the 1st of August to the end of the year, depending on which of Austria's 9 Länder you live in. So you'd have to prove that the killing was made in that time frame. Bambi's mom was clearly killed by a rifle. This was a precision kill. So my final diagnosis on that is that it was probably legal, like it or not. The second attack is when Bambi gets shot while leaping over a log, but he recovers quickly. Now, this is probably legal, but just plain dumb and irresponsible. Now, this is where I agree, where the hunters were being very responsible. So bad hunters, is that the shots were clearly made by a shotgun. They were out hunting pheasants, and what you had was a trigger-happy hunter who took pot shots at Bambi while he was running away, because a shotgun pellet will not penetrate the skin of larger game. And so, in that case, they were being really dumb. So,
there you go.
So, there you go.
There you go.
But anyway, I can tell we're getting a negative backlash from the people in the chat, so maybe I should stop talking about the hunting. So
well,
with that, I am done talking about hunting.
People are not upset with people are just more upset that you keep using the gun sound effect over and over and over again. That's really what people are upset about.
Oh my gosh. It's funny to me. I just, for a second there, and for whatever reason, I can't get my mind off of it, but the whole fact that the fire happened is not something that I always see as a bad thing. For example, I follow this, it's a very conservative or conservationalist type of a feed on Instagram, but it's they basically showed this fire of the Mount Hood in Tucson, Arizona. In 80 years it hadn't caught fire at all, and the person who wrote it said, this is something that on this mountain, which hasn't seen fire in over 80 years, it was born of lightning. And so it has nothing to do with us, but it's actually a good thing, because all this, it will go ahead and it will get rid of all of the mess and all of the debris over the last 80 years. And it will allow everything to kind of grow back better. So I thought that was an interesting tie. So that's why not that specific reason, but I haven't always seen the fire in this movie as necessarily a bad thing, But actually, no, wait.
It was caused by him.
So it was by him. Yeah. So yeah, that was bad. But like, so I take that entire speech back, whatever. But it's just interesting. I myself am not a hunter. I do not see myself.
Well, you're not a huntress.
Huntress.
That's a proper term for it.
I am not a huntress. I do not like killing in general. Anytime I'm driving down the road and I hit a rabbit,
don't like killing,
and
Chelsea?
I'm like, well, I'm driving down the road from Utah and I end up hitting a rabbit or something, and I like, my heart just stops and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry, Thumper. Like,
aww.
it's just, it hurts my heart inside. But
this happens a lot?
Not always, but like, I just got,
I've never hit an animal.
I have, and it hurts.
Dude, one time I hit a big old raccoon.
Yeah, it's just hard.
Texas is the king of roadkill. When I lived there, it was very common to have armadillos, all sorts of things on the side of the road.
No
very
joke.
Sad.
We have armadillos who drink in this state, and they get drunk and they cross the road where they're not supposed to. No. You'll see it if you spend enough time in Texas. You'll see a dead armadillo on the side of the road, upside
the
down, with a beer can right next to him.
I have a great picture of me holding one.
I remember that picture.
Well, not that great, but I mean, I really like armadillos, so I was excited. I got to touch one, and then I realized they're actually like really gross and dirty.
Oh, they're disgusting. But, yeah, but animals are beautiful. Nature is beautiful and all that stuff. But I just think that humans are more beautiful than armadillos. Sorry. So despite what you may politically think about things like guns and hunting, this film is great because it's so complex.
Yeah.
Yes.
If you really dig into the nitty gritty, there is more to it than just bad man, good animal.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there are no animals that are trying to kill the humans, but that's why it's this naturalistic conservationist message that, look, they can't fend for themselves. You know, they didn't start the fires. They don't go shooting each other with guns. So how are we going to be respectful and responsible? And I think that was Walt's original vision. Of course, I'm no spokesperson for Walt Disney, but everything that I have read and analyzed points to that it was more of a complex, level-headed message than you would think.
Yeah, and as you were talking about Gobo, I can't really imagine how he would fit into the story. Like, the story is so simple, yet complex at the same time, in all the levels and different meaning, and just adding that plot line, just, it's interesting, and I actually am really intrigued to go read the book, but it just adds a lot to that. Oh, speaking of Texas...
Yeah.
When I lived in Texas, I knew a lady who was named Feline, and I said, Feline? I've never heard that name except for in Bambi. She's my mom named me after the character in Bambi. She was not impressed with her name.
That's cool.
I was like, I think that's kind of a cool name. So
you should name your son Thumper, or daughter, or whatever, you know, whatever it's going to be. You know, Thumper is kind of can go both ways. There was a James Bond villainess by the name of Thumper, and her cohort was named Bambi. So,
well, there we go. Have you seen the? It's just a video online. I think it's SNL or something where it's the live action, you know, Bambi remake. Because at this point in time, Disney was announcing all sorts of, and they still are, live action remakes. And so the joke was that they are remaking Bambi as sort of a like Rambo. It's pretty funny. I'll include a link in the show notes so you can watch it as well.
Well, back in the 90s, there was a computer game called The Deer Hunter. Except it was The Deer Hunter. Like, the hunter was a deer and you shoot all these rednecks. Which I do not agree with video games that glorify violence against innocent humans. And so you can make the argument that the rednecks aren't that innocent because they're hunters, blah, blah, blah. But so I wouldn't play it. But, you know, there's kind of this, I don't know. I do like the, oh, that's right. That was on SNL with The Rock, wasn't it?
Yes, sorry. I didn't explain it very well. It's with The Rock, and it was a live action Bambi, but with humans playing the characters. And The Rock was Bambi. And yeah.
Has anyone on the chat seen the short film Bambi Meets Godzilla, I think it's called?
No.
You'll have to watch it after this. It's pretty great.
Anyway. Perfect. Okay. Well, any last thoughts about this film? Let's see. Did we We didn't necessarily talk plot by plot, but...
Nah, I like it when we tackle the big deal. Oh, yeah. What is it called? Trepidation? Twitter-pated. Twitter-pated, yeah. Moral of the story, when you get old, you will get Twitter-pated and you will die. So we
Except
can pretty
for
much
Friend
wrap
Owl,
up that.
Apparently.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. Friend Owl is just kind of a friend. Friend Owl's in the friend zone, so they... Friend Owl never
Hence
got Twitter-pated, yeah.
That seems actually really funny because it's everything around them is being Twitter-pated, and the three of them are like the cool like college bros hanging out, and they're all like, "That we're too cool for that. That will never happen to us." And then slowly, one by one, they all find their counterpart. So,
yeah. And then one of the lines that always stuck to me over the years was, "Remember me?" Duck, 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 duck. And he's like, Thumper. Bambi's not the brightest crayon in the box, but that's just like the one line that I remember from this film. Oh, even Flower gets Twitter-pated.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. That's funny. A Twitter patient before Twitter was a thing.
Oh, good times. All right, so I guess we should rate it because our voicemails have nothing to do with this film.
I just want to say that we did really well. I'm really surprised that we came out of that epic monologue about hunting and conservationism without any dislikes. So, hey, don't be disliking just because I said.
Way to go, Mason. You just spoiled our podcast.
Dude, we totally had 20 people viewing at one point. Mm-mm-mm.
We have friends. Yay!
We have friends. Yay!
We are friends.
We are
All right,
friends.
So okay. What do you guys rate this?
Y'all asking us or y'all asking the people, the good people
I'm
in the chat?
I'm asking you to give the chat a little more time to respond.
I'm going to give it 4 stars.
Woo-wee!
Well, yeah, I'll go with 4. I'll put that up. I like this movie because of just, it definitely stands the test of time. It's still one of those movies that everybody knows. Everybody can say that they've, every person should see this movie. It's definitely not one that I think it should be skipped over, particularly if you haven't seen it. And just from the storyline of how intricate it can be, and then also just the art is beautiful. And come on, April Showers, man. April Showers.
April Showers.
So that's me.
Okay. Ah, Thundertube. All right. So I'm struggling between, I'm going to give it 4.5 stars. I was thinking maybe 5, but I think this is just such a classic. I think it's beautiful in the way that it's not only the background paintings, but the way that it's animated, mostly realistic animals, apart from their facial expressions, just everything that that they did to, if you look at these animals compared to the animals from Snow White, they are worlds apart in how anatomically correct they are and how they move. And it's really beautiful and really masters were at work in all aspects of the animation. I love the story. I think it's very simple. It's a coming of age. It's talking about, you know, the realities of life. And there's definitely a moral message to be learned. It's simple yet complex. And every time I watch it, I'm always very, very impressed about how mature this film is.
Mature. Yeah, I think, great word.
I think when you mention to Bambi, like most people think just kids film, but it is far from a kids film.
I don't think
you really
any,
sit down and watch it.
You know, a lot of adults won't watch it.
Yeah.
Because they were scarred for life. They were quote unquote scarred for life as a child watching it. And
it's like,
yes, my T-Rex arms. Gotta do the T-Rex.
4 out of 5.
4 out of 5. Sorry, Morgan. I don't mean to constantly interrupt. Y'all know how excited I get.
We do. Well, that's why we love Mason.
Don't y'all? So, Bambi, this is one that you've just gotta see if you're a Disney fan because it sets itself apart. It takes its time. It's got beautiful artwork. It's quieter, and of course, it's got the super powerful moment of the death of Bambi's mother. That being said, there are more entertaining okay, like, contrast Bambi's death with Mufasa's death. I think that Mufasa's death is a little more entertaining and a little more powerful just because the movie speaks to me more as a whole, The Lion King. And so, as y'all know, that is the 2D animated film that I will forever compare all other 2D animated films to. 4 out of 5 stars, and that's my final offer.
Are you going to do that 4 out of 5 times?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so four out of 4 gunshots out of a high-capacity clip. Which, there's actually no such thing.
All right, so...
What a silence we're on.
I'm only at 3. And the last one.
Well, here we go. Wait for it. There you go.
Very nice, Mason. Very nice. Okay,
this is the last time we do that unless we have a gun-themed... movie that we
voicemail
review. So you better hope we never do Rango again.
Well,
or Fievel Goes West.
We are doing an American Tale 2 next, so get ready, guys. All right, sorry. So I'm gonna read some of the comments on what other people rated it. Young Mind Film said 7 out of 10. D3IM2NTEII says 9 out of 10. Jessica Angus says 8 out of 10, and the nostalgia is 10 out of 10. Alejandro R gives it 4 stars out of 10. Four out of ten, he said. Jeremiah said 4 stars, maybe 4.5. No, 4. It's charming, well made, and powerful. And well, no, Alejandro comes back and said 8. So
okay.
And Brayden says Bambi 2 was LOL. I have not seen
that
Bambi
was like
2.
The awkward years, wasn't it? After
95, past 95, you know.
Oh, okay, the 8 out of 10 was not referring to, or the 4 out of 10, something different. Anyways.
It's a little April shower, speaking of tune as you follow all around.
So, with that...
Yeah, let's start our Ice Age 5 episode real quick.
We are switching gears
Ice Age 5.
We are going to be talking about Ice Age 5, which I have not seen, I don't think Chelsea has seen, and Mason has not seen.
Well, I ain't exactly lactating, pal.
So, our first voicemail is from Rachel. So, Rachel, take it away.
Oh, Rachel.
Hi, Rotoscopers. It's Rachel.
Hi, Rachel.
So I got a chance to see Ice Age 5, and I didn't really like it very much. I'm not really that surprised. I haven't been a big fan of the last 2 entries. And I guess if you like sheer randomness, there's something there. It was very, very random. But I thought that it had a weird kind of... type of humor that I don't really care for, where really the jokes aren't really jokes. They're really just the characters complaining about each other. And I felt there was a lot of that, you know, it was like every character complaining about every character. And then I felt also like there was too many sort of modern jokes that weren't funny. They were just sort of talking about modern stuff, like, you know, using hashtags as a joke. It's not really funny. And so, yeah, I thought it was weak. And it's too bad because I loved the Peanuts movie last year. And it's a real downturn for Blue Sky for me. So, oh, well.
Another tough review by our very own Rachel Wagner. And it's interesting that she said that the brand of comedy was more of the characters complaining about it, about each other. And it's going to happen when the main cast is so dang big.
Yeah.
Like, all of them found mates by now. Manny has, like, 4 kids. Now, there's a franchise that won't let any of the characters die. So
yeah,
I ask you, will you let the franchise die? Do you have the courage to pull the plug on this franchise?
How did it do this weekend?
I think that's sad that, like I said, was mentioned before, none of us have seen this movie. But I think it's really sad that the fact that she said that all of the humor is actually just complaining about each other, which doesn't make me want to go see it at all. Like, I don't want to see where the entire thing is just like backstabbing somebody else's friend. Like, I just don't want to.
Well, apparently we did not want to see this, and neither did anyone else. So the Ice Age Collision Course. Let's look.
What does it even have to do with? Like, how do they stop an asteroid? What is this, Armageddon in the Ice Age?
So Ice Age Collision Course only made $21 million in the opening weekend. It opened in fifth place. There were other movies that were definitely ahead of it. Secret Life of Pets was number two. Still, yet it has been out for a few weeks. And so Ice Age, which was newer, basically, you'd think would do better. But I think that really is kind of an indicator that viewers are kind of done with this. It says, according to Box Office Mojo, until now, no Ice Age film had opened with less than $41 million, and a $21 million debut for its latest feature is a 55% drop compared to the $46.6 million opening of Ice Age Continental Drift. To me, this kind of confirms what I've been feeling, is that we are done. We are saturated. We are just over it at this point.
Cash cow has been milked until its teats are sore.
Yes. Anyway.
To put it graphically.
So, very graphically.
Oh my God. That graphic.
Sorry, I hate to titillate you all, but...
Oh, dear. Our next one is Jeremiah.
No, dear, we're doing Ice Age, not Bambi.
Jeremiah, take it away.
All right, sorry, go help.
You
go
still get thunder tubes.
Hello, Rediscover.
Hey, Jeremiah.
This is Jeremiah calling about Song of the Sea. Although, like the Red Rabbit, I'm late for a very important date.
It happens.
Let's see. I have so many things to say about this movie. Honestly, if somebody were to tell me, I want to talk to you about Song of the Sea for an hour and a half, I'd be absolutely delighted. But, here goes. Let's see. The music, of course, is absolutely lovely. And so are the characters, and so is the animation. And I don't know. It makes you feel everything you're supposed to feel. It has an emotional rhythm to it, almost like a poem. You know, a poem as if it were written with emotion, if that makes any sense. If every syllable was an emotion, and it's happy, it's sad, it's frightening. It's happy, it's sad, it's frightening. It has a rhythm like a poem and the emotion. And you feel every emotion, as I said, you're supposed to feel. So you're with the characters as you're on this journey with them. You feel Saoirse's sadness as she's being carried along on a leash, and it's just that, her pain, and the rain falling and the music, and you feeling exactly what you're supposed to feel. There's never a disconnect. You know, so many movies have, you know, that joke that's supposed to be really funny and you don't laugh, or something that's supposed to be really sad, it's just not. There was nothing like that in here. And it felt also a lot like a story or a myth or a legend. It also felt like a film because it felt very thought out and carefully crafted story-wise, you know, whereas legends or the story just being told to you is more spontaneous, but it also had the feeling somehow of a story being told to you at the same time, and that was just a wonderful accomplishment. I've rarely seen a film that made me feel like this. This thing is an emotional journey all to itself. And, you know, it's just, I'm always going to have these characters in my heart. I'm always going to be amazed by it. I give it 4.5 stars. You know, as a film, I can't give it quite 5, but you know, as just a masterpiece that does things other films don't do, it's so incredibly perfect. At any rate, again, this is Jeremiah. That's my wandering thoughts. I just, you know, I feel like I've seen something bigger than me and seen this film, really. So I just have difficulty.
I think he got cut off because of the length of the message.
Don't.
So we'll never get to know what he was saying. But
except for he's in the comments, so
yeah. Oh, that's true. He's right there on the chat, so
he could finish it up.
He can finish it. Finish it, Jeremiah.
Finish him.
Finish it. Finish him. But
friendship.
Song of the Sea. I really liked it. It was very emotional. It was very clear with the emotions it wanted you to feel, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very good. Very good. Thank you for your review, Jeremiah.
Mm-hmm. Alrighty. Well, that is that, right? That's a wrap for this episode.
Yeah, that's it. I can't think of anything more obnoxious things to say.
I'm sure you could think of something.
Oh, we've peaked at 21 people watching right at the end of our episode. So, bye, everyone.
We have a new interv. David, apparently, says, where am I? You're in a good place.
Well, all right. Yes. Well, thanks for joining us for this episode of the Animation Addicts podcast. Big shout out to everyone who is in the chat, the 21 people joining us live, and everyone else who's having a great discussion in the chat. Thank you so much for everything that you are adding. I love having the chat because we get to really, you know, discuss with you guys and get your guys' feedback. What's working? What's not? What are your thoughts? And again, sorry that we kind of switched this last minute on you. We just couldn't take it anymore. So
we're protesting.
Did Bambi, and I am very happy having watched Bambi and reviewed Bambi. And our next episode is going to be An American Tale.
Woo!
That
I'm so
is
excited.
Another that patron means... pick.
Come on, right when I wanted to do it.
I haven't used the Thunder Tube in a really long time, so I'm
yeah.
Glad
this
to bring
is
going to
be a blast from the past. American Tale 2. So make sure to watch the film.
Final Goes West, man.
I love this
and send
movie.
Us your voicemails. I will include a link on the website at the bottom where you can rent this. I'll include Amazon, iTunes, and then I'll even include a VidAngel link if you are watching it from that. Okay, if you would like to leave a voicemail for that, you can leave us a voicemail at rotoscopers.com/voicemails or give us a call at 406-646-6575. Remember to keep those short and sweet so that way we can have more room for others. And if you would like all the show notes from this episode, go to rotoscopers.com/128, and that's where you can find all of the links for the different things that we were talking about. And lastly, yeah, thank you for joining us. You can find us on social media. Rotoscopers everywhere. All the good things.
All the good things.
All right, guys. Until next time.
All right, we're not officially signing off yet because we got to do the title.
Title.
We should just do this as the title.
You have so many people who hate you right now.
It's,
just so you
it's
know.
Not a fan favorite. It's very polarizing, which is why Mason keeps doing it.
Of course, I love to trigger.
Bambi's favorite rifle. Oh my god.
Bambi, get your gun.
That's terrible.
I like that one. Didn't you say something about the Faline?
Faline is your daughter here yet? Let's see. The matchmaker is not a pleasant pheasant. Or patient pheasant. Twitter pated. Elimination. Lack of Twitter patient.
It's true on many levels.
This is the funnest part of the show when we're bickering with each other trying to figure out the title. Nah, that's not gonna work.
No, and so we give an idea. We're like, okay.
Yes, and.
Nope.
I think there's a bunch of votes for Twitter pated.
Oh, Twitter pated. Got it.
I like Ernesto Check on whatever you guys want. That's right. Let us do our own thing. So what's her title? Nice.
Ah.
Everyone's got a sound effect. I'll raise you a better.
Wait, was that me?
Yeah, that was your cell phone. It was a Zelda ringtone.
Yes, my.
And it was perfect timing right after I made my little speech. With that, we should end it.
All right.
Oh, don't forget, guys. Be a Patreon subscriber. Bye.